Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Soldiers of Cinema podcast. We are your two usually unusual hosts, Clark Coffey and Colin McFader. Of course, I'm Colin. Clark down there in California.
Way down there. Yeah, man. Life is good, man. It's a hot summer afternoon, but I'm pretty cool here in my home.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to be with you once again, as they say up there in Canada, for the discussion on this film that was my choice. But I don't want to introduce it because I don't want to take that away from you.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So the movie that you chose this week is Embrace of the Serpent. It is directed by Ciro Guerra.
Yeah. 2015.
If I butchered the pronunciation of that and many other things, I assume during this episode, I probably will.
You know, we do our best.
Exactly,
Sometimes we mispronounce things and sometimes maybe even our ideas are cuckoo, but you know what? They're ours. And
yes. Nobody can take that away from us.
We're just here having fun, talking about movies. I mean, so how serious could it really be? But
So this one came out in 2015. It was kind of a festival
Colombian
movie. I don't think it got too much of a wide release. I remember it playing at the TIFF Lightbox in Toronto, not for the festival, but just regularly.
Right.
So I do vaguely remember it coming out, but I hadn't seen it. And I don't believe you'd seen it till this week.
No. No, I hadn't seen it either, and I wasn't even aware of it on release. And it's, as much as I love films, I mean, a lot of them, slip through the cracks for me. There's just only so much time, only so many films I can see, even though I feel like I see quite a few. This one, I don't recall this one being released near me, although living in Southern California, I'm sure it probably was somewhere. I hope it was somewhere. Because I think it's certainly deserving of a theatrical release, although it wouldn't be wide, of course. But yeah, like you said, it did get a lot of traction in the festival circuit. And I mean, it even actually, it was submitted by Columbia for the Best Foreign Language Film at the 88th Academy Awards.
Yeah.
So, and it was included among the final five nominees, and it was the first Colombian film to receive a nomination for the Academy Awards. So, I mean, that's pretty decent visibility there. But yeah, it still nonetheless escaped me. And, who knows if I even watched the Academy Awards at that point. But I just had no recollection of it. But how I came to it to recommend it for this was that my wife actually saw it on a plane and she recommended it to me. And I was like, okay, well, I'll check it out. But I wanted to watch it first. So I actually watched it first. And then I thought, yeah, you know what? I think this would be a really interesting film to discuss on the podcast. I thought it was kind of especially interesting because I felt like it had some parallels to some of our previous discussions with Herzog. And of course, his notorious time in the Amazon, right? I mean, that's,
whether for it's several movies.
My Best Fiend, and of course, Aguirre, Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, all three of those films we discussed early on in this podcast's history. And so I thought, hey, this would be like kind of just an interesting circle back to some of the same cinematic landscapes that we discussed in those first films. You're right. My first viewing as well. And what we always kind of like to do to start off our discussion on the films is to kind of talk about our personal experiences with the film. And so, Colin, if you don't mind, kind of share what your just kind of, initial experience viewing the film was.
Yeah. I mean, so I didn't really know much about what it was about at all. I vaguely remember seeing the trailer for it back in 2015, but nothing stuck with, I don't really remember what the trailer even was. And so I didn't watch it prior to watching this. Just figured I would go in with, completely unbiased. And I think the first thing that really jumped out to me is how it doesn't, you have obviously anytime you watch a movie and kind of get the gist of what it's about in a vague sense. I knew it was about the Amazon and, kind of like a journey in the Amazon. I just didn't really know the specifics of it. So you kind of go in with a level of expectation as to what that means. Because of course there have been plenty of movies that are, about, you know, if not a journey on the Amazon River, journeys upriver in a jungle, whether it's, you know, Apocalypse sure. Now, or even just stories in general, Heart of Darkness.
Heart of and Darkness, of course, yeah.
You know, Herzog's even, work, like you mentioned.
Right.
And
it's even kind of a kinship to the road, you know, like a road trip movie. Like,
yes,
the,
exactly. Yeah.
The, like the North yeah. American version, you know, the Canadian, the American, like our version would be the road trip film, right?
Yeah. Where you have all these vignettes along the way, but it's these little stories. Even, yeah.
And even goes so far back, and I'm sure before this, but the earliest, I mean, even something like Canterbury Tales was, yeah. you know, they think this was written in the 1400s, was basically a series of vignettes and stories, you know, this group of people along a journey. So,
yeah.
Obviously a super common thematic element, you know, thematic.
Yeah, and
theme.
Then especially, you know, yeah. especially it being in the jungle, you kind of have expectations of what that's going to entail. So that they'll, you know, I expected things like dealing with bugs or animals or that kind of thing. And I
feel like you need to go into a Herzog voice now. You need to go into Herzog.
The insanity of the jungle.
I just always have that scene where he's being interviewed and is it My Best Fiend? Is that where he's...
I think it's from that. Yeah. Yeah. And he's discussing that. Yeah.
Where it's like the behind the scenes, it's like BTS footage of him, you know, shooting with Kinski doing Fitzcarraldo, where he's just discussing like how it's like the birds aren't singing, they're like screaming in agony.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like the internal chaos of the jungle consuming itself. But you don't.
Okay,
What I think is interesting about this though is that you don't really get that kind of sensationalizing, mm-mm. like that. There is no in this movie. There's no sequence of them falling in the river and a crocodile, like, you know, I know that sounds sort of cheesy, but a lot of these movies, they
no, but it's what it is. A lot of them are
like, there's like a panther or a tiger. Of course there are animals featured in the film, but they're used more as a symbolism for what the film is trying to say, as opposed to, you know, you don't have like a scene where they're sitting around the campfires and someone's complaining about all the bugs and things like that. You know, you don't get that kind of, it almost treats the jungle as, a very respectful,
or even
being,
it's just not
as
the
opposed
focus.
To,
not that I want to steal your, but you're bringing up such interesting things. I know we're still kind of discussing your viewing experience, but just if you'll bear with me here for a moment, I mean, I think because you sparked an idea here. You know, I think like just from the get go with the cinematography, right? We have a black and white cinematography that just immediately kind of plays against what you would normally, like, we don't have any huge establishing shots where we've got, you know, these large landscapes of the Amazon jungle. And it's like, we're just overwhelmed with saturated green, right? You know, a lot of times it'd be like this large Amazonian landscape. And then we'd cut in on some like inserts of like, you know, animals and, you know, the plants just like overwhelming the frame. But this is shot in such a way where the Amazon is actually kind of, I mean, this could have been shot on, it kind of takes away the alienness of the landscape is almost what I feel, because it's not from that perspective, like you're saying. So sorry, I just wanted to, I just had that kind of thought. But even from the beginning of the, you know, the way the way the jungle is framed, the way the river is framed, the way the photography is set, it's just so matter of fact. It's like, we're in the Amazon, but this is home.
Yeah,
this is not an alien landscape. Yeah,
and even you get the idea that even, you know, of course, the just a brief kind of idea about the structure of the movie is that it's set about two journeys up the Amazon River in Colombia, separated by 30 years. So the first one is set in the kind of like around 1910-ish, and the second one, of course, is set in the 1940s. Or like right at 1940, just at the beginning of the Second World War. And so these two timelines kind of coincide with the two major Amazon rubber cycles is what they're called. And it's kind of like a rush to get rubber from
Colombia. Rubber extraction.
And so you have these two stories and, but again, you don't like with our story that takes place earlier is about, a ethnologist, named
Theo from Germany.
Yeah, he's from Germany. He's a real guy, but the film is not like a super accurate retelling, but it's inspired by the diaries that these two explorers kind of made this set time apart. But you don't get this idea that like Theo is even like, he doesn't seem like he's out of place in the jungle in a sense. Like he's not like you know, there are a few moments where he, like, you know, he can't necessarily paddle the boat well and things like that. Like, he certainly has that element to him, but he's mm-hmm. not like, oh my God, a bat. And, you know, it's not like Willie Scott running around in Temple of Doom with like a snake right, on her right. and stuff, you know?
Sure.
yeah. So you don't even have this, you know, everyone kind of just seems very, it seems very tame. Like, you're never, it's presenting the jungle as a character for sure, but it's not presenting it as its kind of usual typecast of this big, scary,
sensationalized, consuming. It's not sensationalized.
Yeah, no. Exactly. Which I thought, you know, that immediately kind of stuck out to me yeah. as something that was interesting and something that was unique about it. And again, yeah. like you said, that is taken very literally in the way that it shot black and white photography and all that. But yeah, and so what is interesting about that too is that you immediately get this sense that, or at least I immediately got this sense that as we are going along and seeing these vignettes, that the circumstances are so much more about the human characters involved in these moments mm-hmm. and not about, you know, the jungle is almost like an innocent bystander that is being hurt through mm. this, like the exploitation that the movie kind of explores, rather than, you know, sort of like a man versus nature style of thing. And so you end up with these, all these vignettes that are very much based around what humans are doing to other humans and how humans are controlling mm. and how humans are bastardizing the nature and the plants and things like that too.
Or impacting each other even.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe less even, because I think that is, but just real quickly here to jump in. I mean, it's certainly there's the element of the kind of the resource extraction and maybe the abuse of the area, but I at least the sense that I got when I was watching it was far from the main focus, that it was rather, you know, a very interpersonal story or a very intimate story about the impacts that individual humans have on each other when we have either collisions of cultures or colonization, resource extraction, or even just the passage of time and how that impacts us. I think there's a lot of interesting layers, that which was something that really jumped out to me when I saw it. But I'll hand it back to you though as you continue.
I thought that it was that immediately made it interesting to me, that this idea that it's not just kind of sensationalizing the dangers of the jungle and nature and things like that. And then it tells a much more kind of human story, and treats almost the humans in it as, you never, I mean, there were a few moments where you have sort of these minor antagonists, I almost want to say, like they're antagonists for really just the scenes that they're in.
Yeah.
And even in those instances, it's not like you're ever given some sort of monologue to understand why we shouldn't like this person or why what they're doing is wrong. Yeah. It just kind of very matter-of-factly shows what's going on, and it treats it in a very, very nuanced kind of moral, you know, almost understanding of what is happening.
Empathetic.
Not necessarily condoning. Certainly being, you know, empathizing with this, and even takes it to an extent that, because of course these stories are set 30 years apart, but there is one character that appears in both stories who is kind of the guide, the indigenous guide, Karamakate.
He's
a shaman for a tribe that he believes has been wiped out. But you actually see the events and the choices that they made on their first journey, or on the first journey, with the, you know, the results and the consequences of that. Those choices later, 30 years later, and which is very interesting because it also kind of shows this idea that, you know, Karamakate, like it, I think one thing that it really shies away from that I think is really, really important, really nuanced, again, kind of emphasizes that nuance, is this trope of like the noble savage that is comes up so frequently when you have stories about indigenous, really anything, or and even
from a Western perspective.
Stories.
Yeah, exactly. From a Western perspective, is the case, yes.
Yeah, a Western filmmaker who will come in and kind of, for whatever reason, you know, there's a million reasons that it's been done, but and some certainly better than others, but you have this kind of, this trope of making it that the indigenous people are kind of seen as this two-dimensional, like one with nature, you know, and it's a very, I think, you know, ultimately a harmful trope, because it, again, it kind of compresses an entire culture with nuance.
Well, it limits the humanity to just a single,
to a single idea.
Their humanity, right?
And so with that, I mean, I think that you kind of get the sense that even this character Karamakate, who again is this shaman, makes those mistakes and kind of has to come across the consequences of those mistakes later on. Mm. That it challenges his idea of, you know, sure, maybe he has an answer to Evan or Theo's issues, that the problems that they're facing as people, he tries to sort of help them with, or at least show them a way. But then he also kind of comes into his own way where he says, like, well, or at least thinks, you know, what am I doing that's correct here? And how am I actually impacting these people? And so it kind of asks those questions, which is very interesting to me. And again, it's just the nuance in that kind of writing is really what stuck out to me. But what was your first impression? Let's hear about yours.
No, that's
now
good.
That I went
that's
on
good.
A long-winded.
No, that's perfect. I'm glad that you had such a a complex reaction to it. I mean, that's regardless of whether you like the film or not like the film, to have a complex reaction to it, I feel like, is the best compliment. I mean, if I that's what I would hope as a filmmaker, for sure. So much of what you said, I think, resonated with me too. I think with many films, I'm impacted by the cinematography, right? Because it's right there in front of you immediately. I just kind of discussed how I was kind of taken by the choice of using black and white cinematography and kind of just skipping all the tropes that we had just talked about how, a Western film, or especially, whether it's even Herzog's films or, Apocalypse Now, this really kind of emphasizing the alienness of the Amazon landscape, right? The having this film be so devoid of all of that, and that we immediately start in a very intimate place where we're meeting the young Karamakate, that really struck me. And it's actually a really beautiful shot that we kind of start with, where we kind of push in on him and there's this reveal. I mean, right off the bat, we have, Theo is revealed as he kind of comes up in the canoe and we see that he's sick. And Manduka, which I don't think is a character. Have we talked about Manduka yet? But he's a character. Yeah, he's an extremely important character. He's been traveling with Theo, and basically, we kind of learn throughout the film that Theo had basically saved or released Manduka from a rubber plantation, from basically enslavement there. And so Manduka has now become his guide and assistant, and is actually quite loyal and defends Theo actually throughout the film, which becomes kind of some moments of friction between him and Karamakate, because Karamakate is like, hey, why in the world are you helping this white man? Like, they bring nothing but death and destruction to our land. Why are you helping him? And it's definitely one of the mechanisms through which I think the filmmaker tries to interject some of that nuance and complexity that you're talking about, the moral complexity, which is important. So I think I was just immediately kind of, captured by that, right? And so we have the introduction of all these characters in that earlier time frame, like you said, around 1909, 1910. Now, we don't know this at the time, but we learn it later. And then we have a credit sequence. And then now we jump right into another timeline. So I was like, ooh, okay, we're going to have two timelines here. This is interesting. And it took me, I'll admit, because I'm very slow and I'm kind of focused on, ooh, the pretty cinematography.
Yes.
And sometimes I'm a little slow. Like, I have to admit, sometimes I'll be watching a film and if I'm watching it with my wife, I will have to I'll have to pause or interrupt the film, which is I'm sorry, wife. But I'll be like, wait, what's going on? I miss these really simple plot cues sometimes. So, but we come into the second timeline, like you said, in the 1940s, where now we have this second white traveler. His name's Evan, and he's American. Both travelers are in search of something. Theo is in search of basically a cure for, and we never really, the film doesn't go into this, but in real life, in his diaries, we know that he suffered and eventually died of malaria in the Amazon. Mm-hmm. But he's clearly very ill. And him and Manduka are seeking some kind of cure or help for his illness. He's clearly really direly sick. And ultimately what that means is that they're looking for a plant, right? They're looking mm-hmm. for medicine to cure him. Well, Evan is also looking for plant. Now, he's kind of a little duplicitous in that he's really actually kind of looking for a disease-resistant rubber plant to take back to the United States to use in a war effort for
Second
World
War.
II.
They used to get the rubber from Southeast Asia. Obviously, that was kind of cut off when
so
the
they're
Japanese
trying to,
kind of expanded.
Right. So they're trying to kind of find ways to help increase their rubber production. But he also is, though, an enthobiologist, right? Mm-hmm. Did I get that right?
Yeah,
that
he's a botanist, yeah.
A botanist. Sorry.
So Theo is an ethnobiologist and Evan is a botanist.
There you go. So they're both, you know, so there is a certain level of like education and respect for where they are. It's not like Evan is just some, you know, like agent of the government or rubber mm-hmm. company. And he's here to, you know, he is here to do this, but he's also a scholar and a scientist. And he's extremely interested and knowledgeable in the native plants that are here in the area. So he also is looking for... Now, they don't use the word ayahuasca in the film, but mm-hmm. ultimately, I think it's kind of clear to see that he's, I think, looking for ayahuasca as well and trying to understand that or even maybe experience it.
Well, because even this character that he's based off of, which is his real name, you know, this Evan...
wrote books on...
Richard Evans Schultz. He actually wrote a book, co-wrote a book with the German inventor chemist of LSD. Swiss, sorry. He clearly later in his life became interested in that stuff or continued an interest in it. So doesn't really come up much in, like, it's not about him figuring out the, you know, the key to
this. But there's this complexity of motive though, which
I
found interesting.
Context.
But I just mean there's these complexity of motives and which just kind of speaks a little more to what you were talking about the, you know, the ethical complexity and nuance and the nuance and complexity in the characters as opposed to being simple tropes. I noticed that too right away. And I was like very relieved because it's, you know, kind of when you see that in a film, you know, when it's like stereotypes and tropes, you're just kind of like, oh, geez, this again.
Yeah, it becomes immediately predictable and
It's just not good storytelling, if nothing else. It's just not good storytelling. So generally speaking, I mean, look, there's places. Goofy action movies, you know, of course, right?
Like we're not looking for the nuance there.
Generally speaking, stuff blows up and whatever, and that's okay. And so I was like very pleased to see that right away. And I was really kind of taken by this, what was going to be clear to kind of be some kind of dual timeline. And it was also kind of clear that not only was it a dual timeline, but that you were going to see a journey that had very much had parallels, these physical parallels, that they're going to go down the river in the same way and go to some of these similar stops. But that they were going to be separated by 30 years, and that we were going to see not just a changed jungle or a changed river, a changed landscape through time, but you were also going to see, especially, and I found this was maybe the most compelling part to me, was how Karamakate was changed. Mm-hmm. Now, Karamakate is an extremely interesting character, and I think used really well by this filmmaker. And so this is, I think, maybe the biggest impact on me when I watched this. And it was the thing that kind of most had me interested to bring it to our podcast to discuss it. So Karamakate, I think, simultaneously is a fantastic symbol for what has happened to his culture to many of the cultures there. And so what I mean by that is that, you know, he represents the last of his tribe. And the reason that his tribe is now reduced to him only, or at least he thinks, is, of course, because of the rubber extraction by European powers and the enslavement and basically near genocide of many of the peoples there, if not just full-on genocide. More nuanced than that, you also have a westernization, a colonization that's happened there. So even those people who are remaining, their cultures are being impacted and kind of overwhelmed by Western culture. And we see some of that by, you know, there's a Spanish mission there where a priest is in charge basically of several dozen orphaned indigenous children. And he actually denies them their language and their, you know, every aspect of their culture is denied as and is labeled as pagan. And they are disciplined, like fiercely flogged if they display that culture. And they're forced to speak Spanish and they're forced to, you know, live in the ways that this Spanish priest thinks they should. So he represents, so it's interesting in the beginning, he's younger, he's 30 years younger, he's like very physically fit, he's strong, he's passionate, he's in command of his environment, we would say, right? He's when we find him 30 years later as an old man, you know, he's still dressed identically to the way he was in the beginning, but we can see now that, you know, he's no longer the stature of his self. He's 30 years older. He's more fragile, but more importantly, he's kind of going through the motions. We see him drawing on this large like rock face. He's, you know, these pictographs. But when Evan asks him what he's drawing, and this is in their first meeting, he says he can't remember. He doesn't know. He can't recall. And he is disconnected from his memories. And he actually, this is the first time we hear him kind of draw a metaphor or kind of draw on this mythology of this creature that roams the jungle. That's like everybody has this mirror of themselves. The second person though is hollow, has no dreams, has no memories, is hollow. And so he says, I think I am that. I have no memories. I have no dreams. I've disconnected. So symbolically, he kind of, I think it's a really effective like symbology to represent the disconnection, right? This culture that the narrative thread has been cut and now there is no memory of this culture from the past, but also on another level, on a more personal individual level, I found it quite fascinating that he also represented, I think, what all of us to some extent probably will experience in our lives if we live long enough to age. I found it quite fascinating that it's this, when we're younger, we're generally filled with dreams and filled with energy and passion. And as we age and we go through this journey, right, that there may be certain aspects of ourselves that we are cut off from, that we lose some of our dreams or that we lose some of our memories or that there's a real fear, right? Or a real possibility that can happen. Yeah. And so I think there was that too, that it doesn't have to even necessarily be so symbolic that it's, well, symbolic, but just in a different level. So that was extremely compelling to me. That really captivated me in this film. And I have to say, I was like pretty emotionally impacted by that. Surprisingly so, actually. I think by the time I got to the end of the film, I find this, you know, sometimes with films that are really a cut above, that, you know, because there's some films, right, you watch and they're quite saccharine and they're like manipulative and, you know, yes, you're like laughing and crying and, you know, you get to the end of it and it's nothing as a surprise. You're totally aware of how you're feeling and why you're feeling it. And you know exactly what the filmmaker did to make you feel that way. And you've kind of gone through the motions and you've had this experience and, you know, that's all well and good and that's fine, but there's no surprise there. Right. There's other films though, I feel like where I get to the end of them and it's like, I don't know why exactly I feel the way I feel. Like I really have to sit in it and think about it and like, whoa, I'm actually surprised I am that emotionally impacted. And generally speaking, for me personally, that's a really big indicator, at least in my eyes, of a quality film. Those were the things that really jumped out to me in my viewing experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think the use of now I'm forgetting his name again.
Karamakate?
Karamakate as the through line, mm-hmm. where there's almost no, I mean, of course, you know, Evan is aware of Theo's journey and is there because he read his book. But
I was going to say, Evan actually has. I just want to interject real quickly because I think it's an interesting note in the film, and that is that Evan actually has. So Theo actually, he's got this journal, and he's, you know, basically a diary, and he's, you know, drawing images of all the people that he's seen and their, you know, face paintings or clothing and, you know, plants and insects, all this stuff, right? He's kind of making notes of all these things. And, of course, that's what Evan has with him and is kind of using as a guide in this second trip down the Amazon with Karamakate 30 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's using these kind of, just like, again, I think it's no coincidence that they changed, because in real life, in the nonfiction version of this story, Theo died much later. He died in the 20s, early 20s, in the Amazon, so similar fashion, but died after the end of the first kind of rubber boom in the Amazon.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that one of the things that they did that's really smart in breaking away from that is you then, in doing so, kind of present this, I think, very, very fundamental point in South American, but especially Colombian history, and you distill it into human relationships and human you know, interaction between very few people. And so you represent it in a much more, not necessarily simple in a negative sense, but in a sense that you understand motivations on a personal basis rather than trying to. I mean, you never even see in this movie, as far as I'm aware and as far as I can remember, and I just watched it yesterday, so I think I remember pretty well, you don't ever see a plantation owner or like a Colombian soldier. You hear them and you hear conversation about them, and there's kind of this impression a few times that they could be, you know, right around the corner. But
right.
Rather than taking what I think is, again, a very fundamental point in this country, all of these different cultures' history, and kind of blowing it up into an epic and saying, like, look at this. This is this incredible run of you know, rubber, this rush of you know, fortunes that like a gold rush kind of thing, right? And you present it, you could present so easily, could present this story that way. And yet
I think there's always the temptation, right, to kind of try to show scale. I think, and and look, there's, and I think that's definitely got value, right? Because there was scale to this. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that just happened in a few places. I mean, you know, countless lives were impacted by this, you know.
Yeah.
Entire countries and entire regions and, you know, entire tribes and cultures were impacted. So there is a scope. You're right. I mean, there is a scope, but they chose to kind of come at it the other angle.
Well, the film doesn't necessarily hide the scope. Like it doesn't present it, but it also, I mean, every single indigenous person we meet along the journey has something to say about plantations or rubber, the harvesting of rubber. Like, so it's very clear, the movie makes it very clear that this is something that affects the people, even the furthest, most isolated communities deep in this jungle that are only accessible by, you know, a 3 days journey on a boat. And it really kind of emphasizes how far reaching these consequences are, but it doesn't necessarily present it in a kind of big cinematic,
epic,
grand kind of fashion. And I think that also makes the final moments, or the final few moments of the movie, very impactful, where the whole movie is, not only is it just set in the jungle, but we spend the entire film on the jungle floor or on a river in flat jungle landscapes.
And
we're never
really
above
intimate
the canopy.
Framing. It's really intimate framing. We're very
longer lenses. I mean, a few wide stuff, but primarily,
not
if
much.
It's wide, it's very close to the characters. So you're always, you know, the characters are always filling the frame. You never are really presenting these characters on a backdrop of a massive vista or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always very, in a sense, kind of claustrophobic. Like, every turn of the river looks the same as the last 10. And so you never really have this sense of where you are geographically. And so it really puts you into that headspace of what it would likely have been like to actually be making this journey, because you just have no idea where you are, how far along you are, where the new, like when the next time you're going to come across any sense of civilization. But then when we, the final moments of the movie, when Evan, when Karamakata actually brings Evan to the kind of original blooming or sprouting place of this fictional, but representative of like, you know, ayahuasca, which is kind of psychedelic plant.
It's, and just to provide context, yeah. It's the remnants of Karamakate's tribe that he thought was lost, right? This is what you're
talking
about?
Yeah, well, so that's when Theo and them arrive. But
you're talking about the very end. So okay, my apologies.
When
they're on the dome, the rock
is,
dome.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Is the only time we get above the canopy is when when Karamakate brings Evan up to experience this, you know, it's kind of a, what do they call it? Like a spirit journey or whatever. Word for it is, but, and it's the only time that we actually are, both our characters are above the canopy, and then we cut to footage from what I assume is a helicopter or a drone or something above the canopy.
You're thinking like Vision Quest.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think it's really brilliant in the way that it kind of juxtaposes those two things, where we have spent the entire film, because, you know, Theo and the characters, they're the end of their journey has a much more, if not explicitly tragic, dour kind of tone. Like, it's not a very, I think that the brilliant part about these two things and how differently these two stories are kind of from each other, how Karamakate is so different from his young self as an old guy, you know, even just in the way that he introduces themselves to these Westerners that are coming in, the young Karamakate is immediately standoffish and aggressive and kind of defensive and says, like, you know, get away. And he threatens to have the blow dart thing, and he's threatening to,
and the only reason he agrees to assist is that Theo basically says, hey, I have actually seen your tribe. There are other members of your tribe left alive. I know where they are. I can take you there.
Yeah.
So that's the only reason that Karamakate, young Karamakate, agrees to assist and go along in this journey.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the end of that journey, the first journey, is him arriving at the remnants of his tribe and realizing that, they've completely bastardized this, what is a very sacred...
The sacred plant
that his tribe has kind of started using it as a recreational drug in a lot of senses, and kind
almost
of
just like alcohol. It's almost a parallel to, like, they're just kind of drunkenly it's an escape as opposed to a ceremonial, an important, respected ceremonial journey or experience
or
medicine.
That clearly makes him, that clearly affects him profoundly, because he burns down the tree, and that's kind of the last time we see the young him, is him standing within the flames, and sort of, and then of course Theo and Manduka run off as the Colombian army comes in. But I think what it also does, what at least the impression I got and the interpretation I kind of took away from it, is that when we end the film with Evan actually finally getting to this spot and Karamakate actually destroying the final tree, but in a much different tone. He's not vengeful and he's not, you know, angry. He kind of, it's almost like he's finally reached this place where they've successfully broken down these divisions between the two of them, and that they, despite the fact they've come from completely different cultures and lives and led entirely different lives and even have different motivations for being right there. I mean, there's even the moment when Evan kind of has this feeble attempt at, like, kind of threatening him with a knife, and Karamakate just does not even really acknowledge it. That you see Karamakate kind of almost, for lack of a better term, like ascend when Evan has this psychedelic experience from the plant. And it's almost like that was his, that he was misinterpreting what his real task was or what his purpose was, and that his purpose now, or what he realizes that his purpose, is kind of preserving this culture as something that can't be, you know, if it's gone, it can't be corrupted in that sort of sense. Like, this kind of, there's a kind of this overarching conversation that's had, especially from Manduka throughout, with, in regards to Theo, but I think Evan kind of represents the same idea, that, you know, our cultures are dying, we're being rooted out of the jungle by these plantations, and our people are being stolen. And if they're not stolen to work on plantations, then they're stolen by these kind of residential schools and converted to Catholics and are mm-hmm. westernized. And these guys, you know, of course, Mandook is talking about Theo, but in a general sense, these researchers are a way of us preserving our culture, and that this he's writing down, he's respected back home, and he's going to go show them that we're not the impression that Europeans have of us. We're not, you know, these stereotypes and these caricatures, that we have culture and nuance. And that, and so Manduka in a lot of ways kind of approaches it as this preservation in a historical or a literary sense. And I think that the ending of the film is kind of realizing the bridge between those two things, and that you have Manduka, who is this westernized indigenous person that is supporting Theo on his journey, and we have the young Kermakate, who is resilient and resistant to what is happening, and is kind of going along because he's been enticed by this promise of seeing again his tribe he assumed was extinct. And so then when we finally get to the point where Evan and old Kermakate are having this kind of experience together, that you do sort of get this sense that, yeah, it's like you're bridging these two ideas together, in that it's almost like an acceptance of the world being the way it is, but at the same time bringing somebody else on that kind of journey and showing them, changing them. You know, Evan changes almost mm-hmm. as much as Kermakate. So,
well, absolutely.
Yeah, so there's I think nuanced ending that comes up with this, not necessarily middle ground. Like, I don't want to pretend it's like, oh, it's, you know, neither sides are right, but it's more that it takes it a step further, in the sense that it's like you kind of have to ascend beyond these very extra, you know, or what's external differences in order to preserve these kind of, like, these beautiful things in life. And, you know.
Yeah. There are things that transcend. You've sparked a lot of thoughts in me. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that really stands out to me in this film is that it's empathetic and it's nuanced in the treatment of all of its characters, which I really appreciate. And I mean, I think, you know, it's for me where I see so much of that, but it's, you know, you see it in all the characterizations, all the characters, but it's also in these vignettes, right, in both timelines as we go down the river. It's, you know, we have in our first timeline, in the first place that we stop, Theo and Manduka and young Kermakate stop at this small village, and there's a tribe there that Theo and Manduka know. They know each other. They've obviously spent time there, and they're very friendly, and so they have like a really relaxed, nice evening there, where, matter of fact, even Theo and Manduka perform in front of the village, and you actually mm-hmm. see young Kermakate laugh, and is actually kind of, it's a first, he kind of has a break in the wall that he's presented to those characters, which I thought was really a sweet moment in the film, an intimate and sweet moment. But in this vignette, you have when they're leaving the next day, so Theo has kind of shown the village his compass and explained what it does and how it works. When he's leaving, he realizes his compass is missing. And so mm-hmm. right before they get back on the canoe to head back out on the river, he approaches the small tribe and says, hey, does somebody have my compass? I don't have it, and we really need it. And ultimately, you know, they kind of, you know, play dumb a little bit. And then eventually they try to give him gifts as an exchange. And he says, I don't want to exchange. I really need the compass. And he gets really frustrated and angry, and even kind of starts to manhandle, you know, one of the younger villagers. And, you know, finally, you know, Kermakate, they're like, okay, you know, we'll leave. We need to leave. And Theo is like, you know, I really need to get that compass. If I leave it here, and we don't know exactly what he's going to say. And I found this was interesting. You know, he says, hey, if we leave the compass here, it's going to replace the ways that they understand to navigate. You know, they navigate by the winds and the stars. And if we leave this compass, they will forget and lose those abilities.
Yeah, it's like a rapid acceleration of technology kind of thing.
And then young Kiramakate says, well, who are you to decide what knowledge they can or can't have? Knowledge is for every, all mankind, all humanity. And so it's interesting that, you know, they are both in parts right, of course, and maybe wrong, you know, too, in equal parts, but that it's a nuanced question, right? And that it is a really challenging situation. We have another moment where it's Manduka and Theo and young Kiramakate again, and they come upon this area in the jungle where it's clear that someone is harvesting latex from the rubber trees. Mm-hmm. And Manduka, having been recently released, you know, from basically, you know, slavery, right, or, you know, in a rubber plantation, is like really triggered and grabs all the buckets and starts overthrowing them and spilling all the latex out onto the jungle floor. And I mean, he's obviously like extremely emotionally affected by this when he sees this. And as soon as he's done doing that, we have this character, this like this one armed, like clearly he's had like an arm
clearly
that
severely being beaten
like
and tortured
cut off.
And stuff. Yeah, yeah.
His face is disfigured and mangled. He's got this makeshift like cast on one of his legs. He can hardly mm-hmm. walk. And he's, you know, he comes into this little clearing or this area where the trees were being harvested. And, you know, he's trying to like just, I mean, just totally fruitlessly, you know, trying to scrape the latex back up off the jungle floor and put it back in the buckets. And he starts like, you know, yelling something to them. And Manduka's like, can you translate this, Kiramakate? And he's like, he's saying, kill me, kill me. Mm-hmm. So basically, Now that all this latex has been spilled, he knows that when the plantation owners or the company people come back, they're going to either torture or, you know, who knows what they'll do to him. It'll be horrible. And we can only imagine just by looking at his body already what he's had to endure. And so Manduka runs and grabs a rifle and comes back, you know, saying, you know, I can't, there's no way I can put him through this. And, or, you know, this hell that he's going to experience if I leave him here. But he's even knowing that he can't bring himself to to kill this man. He can't bring himself to do it. So they leave. And as they leave, we see this man kind of this one last, like just such a sad silhouette in, you know, on the bank of the river at the edge of the jungle. And as soon as the canoe, as they move away from this location, we hear, you know, screaming and gunfire. Mm-hmm. And so it's just this, you know, this like this road to hell is paved with good intent. I don't even know what it is, right? It's not even the road to hell is paved with good intentions. It's just that the impacts that our actions have on people that we or things that we just have no idea how this, you know, it's like obviously Manduka did not have any intention to not only did he have no intention to harm this man. I mean, he completely sympathized with this person as having been in this situation himself, but yet he is the instrument in a strange way of this man's death. Yeah. And I don't know. And even then, do we take that as a release? Do we take that as a good thing or a bad thing? I don't even know. So that kind of, at least to me, and maybe I'm simple, but that kind of complexity presented in such an efficient way in a film is just extremely compelling. I mean, we have also the moment where they arrive at the Spanish mission in the first timeline. And here we see this basically sadistic Spanish priest in charge over, you know, several dozen orphaned indigenous children. And like I said before, you know, he's basically labeled all of their indigenous culture as pagan, right? Mm-hmm. And is trying to teach them his culture. And ultimately what happens is that Manduka sees the priest beating one of the children, comes, and I think he then kills the priest, basically, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And now here they are. There's this group of children. They're at the at this mission. They've got no adult there, and they kind of have this discussion briefly before they leave between Theo and Kiramakate and Manduka, where it's like, well, what do we do? We can't take them with us. We have no way to take them with us. If we leave them here, they will likely die or be killed. And so they just have to leave. And here they've left these
and
children.
They basically tell the kids run off into the jungle, well, basically, right?
Are they better off? Are they worse off? Are they, yeah. Is it neither? We don't know. There is no simple answer. There are complex questions and certainly no simple answers. And of course, when we come back to this mission 30 years later in the second timeline, and now when we've come back with Evan, there's these adults, and the mission, of course, is totally degraded and decrepit. And you could interpret this as that these are these orphans grown up, or you could interpret it that perhaps there's a different group of people who've moved into the mission. My interpretation was that it was these children grown up.
Yeah.
And they had stayed there, and they had taken these so strange aspects of their own culture. And Karamakanti actually says it's the worst of both worlds, mm-hmm. where the children have taken parts of their own culture and have been like, and parts of the Catholic priest culture, and kind of meshed them together in this perversion that is this strange cult where one of the men thinks he's Jesus, and he's got
the man who thinks he's Jesus is clearly a outsider. Like, he clearly is a I think he's supposed to be like a Brazilian. So, like, he's not, I believe, as far as I could tell, that he kind of came and almost like took over as this.
It's possible. I missed that, but totally possible. Totally possible. But that's an interesting interpretation. And that completely could have been what was conveyed, and maybe that had just escaped me in it. But here they are. We have old Karamakanti. And he basically, this man who says he's Jesus, he's got this like child bride who's ill, and asks Karamakanti to cure her, seeing that he's a shaman. And he does, at least to some extent, enough that it convinces them that she's cured. And so there's this huge celebration, and they're basically abusing the ayahuasca as an inebriant instead of as a medicine. Mm-hmm. And Karamakanti, you know, and they ask him to partake, and Karamakanti is like, no, you know, and ultimately Karamakanti poisons their large batch of ayahuasca, and they leave this group of people for dead, almost in the same way they left those children basically for dead in the first timeline. And now you're wondering, you know, was this, you know, what is the moral complexity of this, you know, mm-hmm. what they've done? Mm-hmm. So I just found at every turn. And like you said, you know, at the end, when we get to the end of the second timeline with Evan, and Karamakanti has taken him to the top of this dome where there's the last remaining flower. And he actually, you know, makes the medicine for Evan. And you're right. And Evan kind of has this moment where, you know, at first Karamakanti is like refusing, you know, him now, and Evan's like, I'm going to get what I need come hell or high water. And he tries to kind of pull out a knife on him, but we see Karamakanti kind of that vigor and that strength come back, and immediately just overtakes Evan, right? Evan doesn't really have too much fight in him in comparison. And mm-hmm. ultimately Karamakanti shares the medicine with Evan. And then we have the only moments of color in the entire film, which is this, it's all, I kind of thought of, it reminded me of almost like the 2001 moment, you know, but mm-hmm. it's this beautiful color kaleidoscopic, you know, like abstract moments, this representation of this vision quest, like you said, where he's on this journey on the ayahuasca. And then when he awakens from this journey, or kind of returns from this inner journey, he's left alone on that rock dome, and no sign of Karamakanti. We have no idea where he went. But it just to kind of speak to what you had talked about, this transformation in Karamakanti at the end. I mean, he says very specifically, he says, you know, I thought that my goal was to teach my people this medicine, but in reality, what I realized, my goal was to share this with you so that you could take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we're left at the very end after this vision quest, and Evan kind of comes down off the mountain alone. Now the last shot is really beautiful. He's standing at the bank of the Amazon, and there's these surrounded by butterflies. And we had seen previously early in the film that Karamakate, there's a moment that almost kind of in passing, and of course we don't realize the significance until we come to this moment at the end with Evan, but mm-hmm. Karamakate is surrounded by these white butterflies fluttering around him on the bank of the Amazon. And so we kind of the symbolic representation of the culture being transmitted ultimately from the shaman who held it indigenously to Evan, which was mm-hmm. quite beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that it definitely approaches, again, I mean, we've used the word nuance so many times in this, but I think it definitely approaches all these things in a very human and again, like, very interpersonal way that these ideas are representative of a much larger systems and much larger events and things like that. And yet when you present them in a sense that you can immediately digest these ideas because you're understanding the dynamic between these two people, or these three people in the case of the earlier voyage, I think the film does like a really brilliant job of just, putting those ideas to very human, which I think is also, I mean, I also want to specify that it's not, and I sort of touched on this earlier, but it's not done conversationally. Like, it's like so little mm-hmm. is revealed through explicit conversation yep. in this movie.
Thank God.
They have conversation about the exactly, yeah. But it's like so much of this, I think one of the reasons that I think we have, and I think this has been a very fun element of this conversation, has been that we are kind of almost like filling each other in on each other's interpretations. And the reason that is the case is because it's never very explicit. It's never really explicitly saying anything with these very, very simple and clear words. Like, you don't get Karamakate sitting down with Evan and saying, like, well, here, now I'm going to pass my knowledge onto you through this. Or even Manduka saying, oh, I worked on one of these plantations and I was tortured and abused, and this is why I'm throwing out the rubber here. And
it's so sad that we even have to
specify mention. that's a good thing. Yeah. But I mean, you do end up with, and I think that this is a style of filmmaking and a style of storytelling that would have been commonplace, mm-hmm. And in a certain era of filmmaking, which I think we both very much enjoy.
Well, look, it would have been commonplace during the entire silent film era. It would have been,
I think that the style, I think that's one of the reasons that stuck out to me so much. And I think that that's also one of the reasons that, again, we've kind of briefly touched on this Herzogian element to it, which is very present. I don't know how intentional it is. I have no idea if it's intentional at all, if there's any, like, semblance of connection on the director's part. But it certainly touches on a lot of similar themes. And, Herzog, as we kind of spoke about it way back, is kind of the king of this idea of like fact versus truth, that he will, even in his documentaries, make up very blatant, basically lies about certain elements that actually end up representing the truth of the emotional
the
truth
aesthetic
of a
truth.
Moment.
The aesthetic and, truth.
Yeah, the yeah. aesthetic truth, yep. much better than presenting a factual
Just
retelling
a,
of a certain
an accountant's.
Situation.
Or, an accountant's yeah. ledger of facts, right? Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the things that you get with this, is that I'm sure if I read the diaries of Richard Evan Schultz and Theodore Koch Grunberg, who are their real names, I'm sure I would find very interesting stories. I'm sure the stories are rich with like incredible anecdotes and stories about these journeys. However, does it get to, in those very non-fictional kind of ways, does it get to the actual heart of what this of what these events meant to the people that experienced them? I don't know, maybe, but I also think that your job as a filmmaker, and I think that Ciro Guerra did a great job with this, is to get to that emotional heart and to you know, I think this film has been deservedly lauded by both, you know, critics worldwide, but also the indigenous tribes that it portrays, or at least in part portrays, because of that nuance, because it doesn't just present it as such a two-dimensional, you know, classical tale of, you know, oh, the betrayal of X, yeah. Y, and Z, and well, all this stuff. It shows it in a so much more of the, like, the complexities and the tragedy, really, of trying to stop these situations where you actually, you kind of mentioned this earlier too, but you get this, again, this almost opposite sides of the coin when Theodore is trying to, or Theo is trying to prevent them from keeping the compass, and you've got Karamakate telling them that you know, you can't stop that progress, despite the fact that in a grand scheme of things, they're actually kind of doing the opposite. That Theodore and Evan at a later date trying to find this kind of new passage for rubber to be exported to the United States is almost bringing in that industry and bringing in that rapid cultural advancement and technological advancement in almost a culture shock kind of way, despite the fact that they kind of, in this very surface level sort of way, say, like, oh no, I can't leave this compass there. Like the compass is small potatoes in the, you know, the colonization and uprooting of the Amazon by rubber plantations. Sure, and yet this one tiny thing is kind of so, you know, expressly stressed on by Theo. So I think that, yeah, it's just super well done.
Yeah. Kind of. Well, and I think it's just, yeah, and it just, as we kind of wrap up here, I mean, I just think, you know, sometimes, you know, it's just the existential quagmire. I don't even know if it's a quagmire, maybe it's just a soup, but the existential soup of just, you know, all these things, it's just the world is just filled with living things trying to do what they know how to do. And there's no way to not understate this, but it's just, humanity is just very challenging. But I think, you know, on just to kind of end on a note, you know, it's like you talked about kind of the seeming parallels potentially, or at least superficially, to, like, you know, something like Heart of Darkness. I will say that even though this film obviously illustrates a lot of horrors, really, of course, they're horrors in the film, but they're horrors because so many of these things, and even worse, have actually happened, you know, to countless people in real life, and that obviously is a profound horror. But the film finds a way, I think, to end not with darkness, but with light, and with hope, and so. Right on, man. Well, I really, really enjoyed listening to your perspectives. Like you said, it's so fun to kind of hear, you know, you'd kind of caused me to see things that I hadn't seen, or see them from different angles, and maybe hopefully vice versa. Likewise you, and hopefully to an audience out there as well. If you've not seen the film, please go see it. It's really a fantastic film. I couldn't recommend it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's available on a few, I think here it's available on Apple TV and a few different things, so pretty easy to access if you want to watch it, and I think we would both recommend it. I think that it's, this conversation will probably make a lot more sense if you do watch it, so.
yeah, absolutely, and not that that's our thing, but two thumbs up, apparently.
Yes. All right.
Well, Cullen, I look forward to your pick next time. And as always, really enjoyed our conversation. And to everyone out there, we thank you so much for listening. And until next time, we'll catch you on the flip side.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.